Well, good evening and welcome to this Forum for European Philosophy event on Can a Country Be Proud of Its Past? We've got one or two apologies, I'm afraid. Jay Winter has been unable to make it. He's waylaid in Singapore. And Robert Eagleston is also unable to make it this evening. But we're delighted to have Sara Amighetti, who's a PhD candidate in political science at University College London, and Mihaela Mihai from the University of Edinburgh in the politics department, lecturer in the politics department. The question in our title perhaps is a little odd. Can a country be proud of its past? Rather depends on which country we're talking about. Rather depends on what the country's past is like. And you might think that that's a better question for a historian rather than a philosopher. Well, historical questions, I'm sure, will come up, but the question that we have in mind is slightly deeper than that, perhaps more fundamental. And we want to know whether a country can be proud of its past. We want to know whether normative attitudes like pride or shame or guilt are ever appropriate for us to take towards the country that we belong to, or whether they're ever appropriate for a country to take towards itself. Well, before we get into this question and some other related questions, I'd like to ask each of our panellists just to say a little bit about themselves and their interest in this topic, and also perhaps just foreshadow a little bit the kind of perspective that they'll take. So let's begin with Sara.
All right. So, hi, everyone, and welcome to this panel discussion. Thanks for inviting me. As Peter said, I'm a PhD student at University College London, and my thesis is more about issues of global justice, and in particular the kinds of egalitarian duties that we might have in a global context. But I've been caught in the past 2 years, I've been working on a side project with another PhD student from the University of Cambridge, that addresses the issue of reparations for past injustices like slavery and colonialism. So that's how my interest and my work in this kind of area started. And it's obviously connected also to my other research on egalitarianism and global justice. With respect to the questions that we are addressing tonight, I thought when I, you know, I start thinking about what my position was on this, I sort of have conflicting intuitions. In part, I think that a country can be proud of its past, and if we think, I start thinking about the opening ceremony at the London 2012 Olympics, and that was a nice snapshot of what the UK is proud of concerning its past history. So we had a celebration of the achievements of the Industrial Revolutions and also of the way in which this country was able to overcome some of the problems, the social problems that came along with those advancements in the industry and in the economy. So there was a celebration of the NHS, but also of great inventors such as great inventions and inventors, such as the inventor of the World Wide Web, and the stories of Harry Potter and Mary Poppins. So this gives us a nice snapshot and a preliminary answer to the question that we are addressing today. Yes, a country can be proud of its past achievements. I think that there are underpinning, though, two related sets of questions. So that are slightly more interesting for political philosophers. The first is, even if we approach this question from a descriptive point of view, as I've done with the example of the London Olympics, there is still a question about what is a country? What do we mean when we talk about a country? Is there the aggregation of the individuals that live on a certain territory? Is the idea of a nation that we are hitting at? What is it? And the second, another question, more normative, is not whether a country can be proud of its past, but whether it should. And what are the kinds of things that deserve our pride as members of a country, however we define it. So I think, you know, when we look into these more normative questions, our intuitions start to be less less straightforward or less decisive, probably, and it's where things get a bit more complicated.
Thank you, Mihaela.
Thank you first for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. I'm very happy to be here, and it's wonderful that I see some familiar faces in the audience. My work has focused so far on the state as an agent of memory, the state as an engineer of public memory, and I've looked so far in my work at political trials, I've looked at practices of political apologies, I've looked at the way in which the state deals with certain architectural constructs that sit uneasily within a democratic public space, and I think this is the reason why I was asked to comment on this topic. Now I'm shifting a little bit my interest, and I'm looking at the way in which art, literature, and cinema can provide counter stories and alternative visions of the past to the ones proposed by the state institutions. I think the question is very interesting, the question that we were asked to answer, but I want to maybe be a little bit undisciplined and say that maybe talking about the sins of the fathers or talking about guilt of nation, it's a little bit problematic. And I want to propose a different question. And the question I want to propose is the question, what kind of society do we want to be given our past? So not shift a little bit the focus and try to direct our attention to the fact that every question about the past is always simultaneously about the present and about the future and the kind of identity we want to cultivate as a democratic society. Can we be a society that has the courage to live up to its principles, democratic principles of equal respect and concern for every member? Yeah. Can we have the courage to address the inequities that we inherited from the past and that continue to influence various individuals' life prospects within our society? Or do we become the kind of society that is oblivious to the ways in which privilege and disadvantage is reproduced historically from one generation to the other? And unfortunately, most Western affluent societies have chosen the path of selective oblivion and have made only superficial and, I would say, tokenistic attempts to address a shameful past of injustice, oppression, and exploitation. And I can, of course, give you some examples of the ways in which governments manufacture history in ways that always harks back to a glorious past. We can, of course, mention the Australian and the Canadian apologies for the residential school system. As you probably know, Indigenous children were kidnapped and regimented in schools that were sponsored by the state with the declared aim of taking the Indian out of the child. Of course, both Canada and Australia apologized. Canada established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but these institutions did not revise meaningfully the relationships between the First Nations and the settled colonial state. We can talk about France and its portrayal as the cradle of civilization and the cradle of liberal rights, the cradle of the rights of man and of the citizen, and at the same time we can very easily observe within its territory the political and geographical segregation of its population along racialized lines, very obvious racialized lines. And of course, I can provocatively say that we can remember Blair's half apology. I wouldn't even call it an apology for slavery and for Britain's participation in the Atlantic slave trade, and the way in which he actually focused mainly on the role of Britain in the abolitionist movement and portrayed Britain as a champion of abolitionists without, you know, portraying and talking or problematizing or putting out there the other dark side of Britain's benefits and Britain's advantages from the slave trade. So this is just a quick summary of where I come from.
Thank you very much. And would I be right, Mihaela, in saying that in some of what you say, you would like to skip over the question of whether people can be jointly responsible, whether a country can be proud of the past, and take that as a given assumption that clearly we do have these attitudes like pride and shame and so on to our collective history, and then it's a question of how we can harness that and bring something positive out of it.
Yes, I must say that I find it very often highly problematic to read philosophical writing on historical injustice because of the ways in which the use of concepts and the use of frameworks is used to prevent a meaningful discussion about what happened in the past. There's a certain ahistorical type of thinking about the past that is, I think, highly problematic. And I think it's unproblematic, maybe I'm going to be proven wrong by the public here, that, you know, the state is a continuous institution across generations. The state and the citizens of that state benefit and enjoy from historical injustices, and disadvantages are reproduced. I mean, statistically, if you look at the distribution of wealth and the distribution of opportunities within most affluent Western societies, you can immediately see the effect of historical injustice. And sociologists, social theorists have shown this for many, 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 many years, yes? And it seems to be a little bit difficult for philosophy to incorporate the findings of sociology, the findings of political science, and to, you know, honestly and meaningfully engage with the issue of, you know, what should be done.
Yeah.
And what should be done, it's a question about politics, but it's also a question about philosophy, right? It's turning the gaze also on philosophy and the effect of historical injustice on the makeup of philosophy as a discipline and as a group.
Sorry, what about you? Do you think there's a good question to be asked? To what extent does membership of a nation actually give you some collective responsibility and gives you some... does it make it appropriate for you to have certain attitudes like shame and guilt? So I suppose, so speaking as the philosopher on the panel, I want to stick up for the kind of perhaps ahistorical way of approaching the question, because there is a natural way of thinking, isn't there, which says, well, I'm an individual, I'm responsible for the things that I've done. Pride seems to entail that a sense of responsibility. You can't be proud of things that you haven't done, that you're not responsible for. And I'm not responsible for all these things that my country has done in the past because I wasn't there. Mm. So whether those things are good things or bad things, the whole idea of a country being proud of its past does look, on the face of it, perhaps problematic. Does it seem to you like a good question to ask that whether that could be so in the first place?
I think it is an interesting question. And it's something that when I started working on this was, in fact, somehow a problem, right? Because the philosophical literature is divided into theories that profess a sort of normative individualism. So what matters is the individuals and what individuals have done. But when we think about individual history and you know, collective responsibility, then our responsibilities as an individual, even if we're a member, we're still a member of that collective, are a bit difficult to tease out, precisely because what philosophers have called the non-identity problem. Mm-hmm. So the non-identity problem basically refers precisely to what you were suggesting, the fact that why should I be responsible for something that I wasn't directly involved in, that wasn't caused by my actions? Why should we be responsible for the sins of our fathers? But this is... And this is a very complicated problem. In the work that Alan and I did, we sort of bracketed the question, and we looked at another tradition in political philosophy that is a communitarian tradition or a liberal nationalist tradition, which looks at nations as the units of moral concern. So, from a liberal nationalist point of view, of course, it is possible for a nation to inherit responsibility. In fact, you know, by defining nations as ethical and historical communities, they are precisely in a position to defend the idea that as nations we inherit responsibility for our past actions. And so this is also interesting because both I think Alasia and I are not, would resist defining ourselves as liberal nationalists. But that was a useful starting point. Then you, on the basis of that, you can criticise also this particular understanding of collective agents as nations, but still recognise that they concrete starting points are real and worth exploring. So the idea of a public culture that develops in which all of us are parked in one way or another through our daily actions and through the institutional mechanisms that we support today, that I think is an insight that we can preserve, adding the kinds of concerns and worries that Mihaela was considering. So even if today our institutions profess equality and liberty and freedom, it's not always been the case. And there seems to be a sort of residual injustice, even if today formally we recognise those institutions and our polities as democratic and egalitarian. So I think there are interesting questions. I don't think I have the answers to all of these very, very difficult questions. I mean, the non-identity problem, for example, is something that has concerned philosophers for a long time and where there is a lot of disagreement. But one way is to look at these other tradition and start criticising them or use them to challenge our own intuitions and see whether there is something to be saved about what they say.
Mihaela, what would you say about the non-identity problem in that case? Is that a sort of non-problem? Or
it's not a non-problem, but I think it's an unproductive way of thinking about the problem. Of course it wasn't me. Of course it wasn't me and I didn't do it, right? But I am part of a community, of a political community, towards which I developed feeling of allegiance and loyalty, feelings that have been socialized, are the product of schooling, are the product of the nation or the state's myth-making process, and these feelings have been inculcated into me, like they are inculcated in every school child through, the Olympics, national celebrations, memorialization practices, rituals of investiture, you name it, right? So, of course, I feel pride. But in the same way, I don't feel pride for something I've done. Societies don't function on this individual framework. So practice the politics of memory and the politics of socialization into pride for the achievements of a state cannot be captured, I think, productively in the language of individual agency. It wasn't me and I didn't do it, but I live in a society where, as a white person coming from an affluent background, I benefit from a variety of things that would not have been possible had it not been for a history of abuse and exploitation. I'm just giving you a small anecdote. I last year, so I'm new to Scotland, I'm new to the UK in general, but last year I attended a history lecture by one of the most famous historians of Scotland, Tom Devine. And he was talking about the issue of participation into the Atlantic slave trade by Scotland, something that is not usually talked about, and it's not talked as frequently as one talks about England's benefits and England's participation into the slave trade. And he explained, the most important cities in Scotland, the most important universities in Scotland have been founded on money that comes from the slave trade. And I work now in such a university, and I benefit from their existence. I benefit from the existence of these great cities, and I live a very prosperous and happy life there. Something that cannot be said in the same way about Caribbean Brits, right? So last week, I don't know if you saw that, there was a statistical study published in the newspaper about social mobility. And the one category that systematically lags behind in terms of social mobility is the group of young Caribbean British, Brits. Yeah. So You see, it's very difficult for me to start thinking about the non-identity problem when it's historically so clear that, you know, there are large benefits, structural benefits, and there are large continuities in terms of the disadvantage, the historical disadvantage, that it's not just a thing in the past, it's something that continues to structure our society again and again and again.
Fantastic. So there's actually a bit of a proximity emerging between your two positions, where you think that pride and these normative attitudes are things that we should really take for granted, and then it's a matter of working out what the best way to go from there is. Philosophers are sort of stuck with these kinds of more sort of normative problems that they think are really fundamental, but actually there's a sort of certain immaturity towards that way of questioning. It wasn't me and I didn't do it, sort of won't fly. Well, let's bring our audience in that case on this question. Are there any questions from the audience? Yes, in the middle there. If you could wait for the microphone, because there's a podcast of the event, and we want everybody to be on that.
Good evening. Thank you very much, guys. My name is Stuart McIver. I own a company called Get Best Brand. My question about pride is a fairly simple one, which is we have a tendency as a society, whether it be in our histories or as individuals, to only talk about the negative aspects. You've made a great example of the Olympics and in terms of some of the really great things that have happened. But that is a rare example. We seem to fixate almost exclusively on the negative aspects of history in terms of how we talk about it, which means that the pride concept is somehow flawed because it doesn't take into account the totality of what has gone in the past. So my question to you is, do you also believe that it's flawed in that way? And is there something we should do to address that? Or should we just fixate on the plague of the past and consider that tomorrow's fate?
Would you like to respond to that straight away?
Right. So I think that there is a problem when we look at the past and, you know, we select things that we... that are the objects, or that can be the objects of our pride. One problem is, you know, when we look at the past and we want to have a more encompassing attitude, then I'm not sure how encompassing that can be, in the sense that, you know, knowledge is limited, there are things that we keep discovering about the past, but for sure, I mean, we should be wary of how our selection operates. That's what I was mentioning at the beginning. So what are the things that merit our pride if we agree that, you know, there are things that we can be proud of? Mm. And possibly, you know, even if we look at histories of injustice, there might be things that we can still be proud of. So, you know, if we look at the history of slavery and the implications of the UK in slave trade, you know, a lot of people point out the fact that, you know, it's the anti-slavery movement started precisely here. And these are the kinds of stories that you hear most of the time. And similarly, when it comes to colonialism, a lot of people say, "Well, you know, it's probably something that we should be ashamed of." And this is a statistic that came out last year from YouGov. 59% of Brits still think are proud of the British Empire. This goes up to 65% among people who are over 60s. And what's worrying to some extent is that 48% of young people, so people between 18 and 24, also think that they should be proud of, that they are proud of the British Empire. And I think another interesting point is that these people tend to think that colonies are better off now than they would have otherwise been if they weren't colonized. So these are worrying attitudes in a way, they show that we can have an encompassing view about the past. So, of course, colonialism entails some injustices, but overall, you know, we can say that those injustices somehow are in balance with the benefits, if not outweigh the benefits that it brought to the former colonies. So I think that looking at the past in this somehow uncritical way and avoiding to acknowledge the legacy of those injustices today and the fact that certain kinds of inequalities still operate through the structures, as Michaela was mentioning, it should be acknowledged and it's something that we should really be well aware of.
Thank you for a great question. I think that we don't fixate on the negatives. I think we tend to think that we are obsessing about the negatives and forget about the good things, because whenever a negative story is problematized and is being debated, it's very uncomfortable, right? We don't like to take the skeletons out of the closet, and it's absolutely natural that we should feel uncomfortable, right? Now, the question is, then what, right? So what? The question is not then to jump to the conclusion that we should cultivate a form of shame, right? Because that's definitely not the solution. I think that I agree fundamentally with Sarah that what we need is a reflective form of pride, and it's a form of civic courage to have a more differentiated understanding and a more discriminating understanding of our history. And always ask, who is proud of what? How many people feel allegiance to the political project that we feel allegiance to, right? Do all groups within a society feel the same kind of solidarity or the same kind of commitment to the political project? Or maybe we can investigate whose voices are excluded and which are those groups that cannot very easily identify and feel pride for the state and the form it takes today. You see what I mean? Right, so I keep thinking about the great literature that comes out of the abolitionist literature in the US, and the great question, who is celebrating 4th of July before, the abolition, and who's going to celebrate it afterwards? Who benefits from the image of a solidary, cohesive society, right? So we need to have a little bit more discrimination in thinking about the past, but not shaming. I think a courageous form of pride in having the courage to admit that it's not all rosy in the past, is what we should aim for.
Well, let's take another couple of questions. Perhaps we'll take two in a row. We've got a lady at the front here, and we've got a gentleman right at the back.
I go first.
Please.
Yeah,
do.
It says here, thinking in public, and I'm going to attempt to think and reflect in public. I don't know whether I have anything at all important to say, but this subject made me think. Country to be proud of its past. And then I was thinking about past empires and small and big countries like Rome, Egypt, Greece, Babel, and then I was thinking, what did they leave us, really? Mind you, I'm quite ignorant of history. What do they leave us? But then I think maybe the concept of that, the police that Hannah Arendt talks about quite often. But then I was thinking that how should we should strive for pride if a country and all its citizens, if they could keep their moral only for one day, and that it's impossible, it's a miracle. But then I think pride is not something intellectual, it is irrational. If I achieve something and somebody plays my national anthem, I'm full of pride. But this is irrational. One cannot possibly be proud. That's my opinion. It's only a statement.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the gentleman at the back.
Hello. So basically the question I have is, we mentioned, I like the fact that you mentioned, both of you, national liberalism. So basically the question is, why do we put the concept of identity and pride into, why don't we separate, first of all, society with politics? For instance, everybody more or less knows the example of Germany, and you have years and centuries of a national identity that came out of culture and social norms and communication between different states. And then you have a state, and the state really did something very bad. And then the whole concept of identity was, of a national identity was almost ridiculed in a way. I'm not German, I'm not familiar with how it's represented, but I can feel that it's, but it's represented in a bad way. And the question is, why do we do this over many countries? Is, like, for instance, is modern the Israeli identity, for instance, is it the policies of Netanyahu government? Is it, why is this kind of connection? Do we need separation? Or in the case of British Empire slave trade, are the people who lived in Britain and took dividends and never had any, I think, to do with Caribbean colonies, and they just took money from sugar plantations that never met, but just because they inherited. And that's what the gentleman used to mean, right? Passive income, the dividend beneficiaries. Did they have, are they are to blame, or who is to blame? The people who bought these slaves from other slavers in Africa? It's you know, I understand that politics takes, is a very important factor in forming identity, forming states, in, you know, directing politics, but I don't want to take more of your time. I think my question is clear. Thank you.
I think we've got just time for one more question in the centre here.
Thank you. In questioning how we should reflect on our country's respective pasts, I wonder whether, and this speaker seemed to suggest, both of you seem to suggest that we should be questioning, questioning the nature of the stories that we tell. But I wonder, what would you say? How appropriate do you think it is to retrospectively apply present day norms to these questions? Thank you.
Fantastic. Okay, so just to perhaps recap a little bit, and then feel free to jump in on any of these aspects. So the first questioner talked about the idea of inheritance and whether inheritance might be a source of pride. You might inherit ideals of democracy or something like that from Greece and Rome, and that could be a reason to feel pride. The second questioner talked about identity and whether there was a difference between state actions and the actions of a nation and who bears the responsibility. And the third question was about should we or can we apply present day norms to things like the British Empire.
Thank you very much for a set of very exciting questions. Just to put it out there, I don't subscribe to the liberal nationalist doctrine. I have a more political understanding of the community. In terms of identity is a complex mix, right? And it has a variety of sources, normative, religious, historical sources. So it's very difficult to say that within a certain political community at a certain point in time, we have a unified identity and we have a unified vision of the past. Having said that, it tends to be the case that the state is one of the most important and most powerful agent of memory and does tend to dictate the terms of the political debate. What I think Sarah and I are trying to do here today is to say that maybe the debate about identity and about who we are and about who we are in view of what our past has been should be a more plurivocal, a more kaleidoscopic discussion, right? So we want to have countervailing forces and countervailing voices that can make the discussion a little bit more inclusive, a little bit more interesting, right? And a little bit more critical and more reflective. So that's how I see identity. I don't think that it makes much sense to think about it in terms of uniformity. Now, present day, the presentism discussion. Look, abolitionist thinkers, if you again look at the literature that comes from the US, they were using, you know, the language of the US Constitution, the language of liberalism. They were using the norms of the time to claim for themselves the same rights and the same authority that the others had. So I think that already at the time, the language that was being used was the language of the time, and it's the language that we have inherited as children of modernity or children of liberalism. You know, Martin Luther King, if you think farther, you know, into the 20th century, the language that was used was a language that was very much shared, only that certain parts of humanity were excluded from having a voice, were excluded from politics, were excluded from humanity itself, right? So the claiming of those who resisted was done in the language that we still speak today. So I don't see the presentism as a problem. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Sarah can...
No, with respect to this question... one way to look at it maybe is to consider examples in which that history still plays a role today, right? So if you consider, the history of slavery and the involvement of this country into slavery, the traces that we can still appreciate today, apart from those that the kinds of disadvantages that Mihana was mentioning earlier, are also to do... in the context of university, for example. So at UCL, there is, it's not just UCL, it's also King's College, and probably I'm not aware of any campaign near the LSE, but probably there is one here as well. There is a campaign asking, why is my curriculum white? So even the way in which we teach today and we try to uphold to the principles of equality today, we do that having a historical baggage that still influences us. So if you think it is a problem to maybe apply the kinds of norms and principles that we've got at through a history of moral progress as well to past injustices, then one way to look at it is, well, but these injustices are still affecting us today. They still play a role today, and you can see it if you take any course syllabus in any of the political philosophy courses that we teach. Philosophers, that the readings are all European thinkers. I think that is a problem. So, and we don't need to look that far back to see that there is a problem. With respect to the questions of national identity and the separation of the nation from the state, so again, I don't identify myself either with the liberal nationalist project. In fact, I wouldn't even define myself as very patriotic, but that's another question. I think it is a useful starting point. Philosophy has to start somewhere, and I think, unlike those that concern themselves with the non-identity problem, I think a useful starting point is by looking at the fact that nation and the nation-state is still a powerful concept or a powerful idea in our world today. So it warrants our attention, but in a critical way, right? Mm-hmm. So. And in our work, I think this attention is precisely that of flashing out differences between what a nationalist project is about and what the concept of the state, how the concept of the state differs from that project. I think that most work in political philosophy tend to look at the nations as precisely having this continuity in history, whether you probably wouldn't be able to say the same for the state. I mean, there are disagreements about this. The fact that we can completely detach politics from our history, I personally don't think that that's possible. History is always a political process, precisely because it connects with the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and on the basis of who we are and who we want to be. So this aspect of constructing narratives is political, and it needs to be inclusive. Unfortunately, it's not enough inclusive probably, and that's I think something that we share.
Can I just one small thing, because I think it's very much worth emphasizing. I think I hinted at it in my introductory remarks, but now you actually put it out there seriously. And I think it's the point about the role of philosophy and the role of philosophy in the history of exclusion and the way in which philosophy has often justified fundamentally oppressive relationships and the way in which philosophy has colluded with great imperial powers in their colonial enterprises. And I think that we cannot not touch on the necessity for philosophy and philosophers to turn their gaze back on themselves and on the structure of the discipline, the content of the curriculum, the sociology of the discipline, and think hard whose voices are being excluded, what ways of knowing are being excluded. I think this is quite relevant for you as an epistemologist. How can we pluralize philosophy itself and the identity of what counts as knowledge in our societies?
Thanks. I mean, I'll just pick up a little bit on the idea of presentism as well. Perhaps someone would like to jump in and correct me, but I suppose I don't see the trouble with applying today's standards to things in the past, because they're not just today's standards. So as an epistemologist, we think about looking back at people's beliefs in the past. People believed all sorts of things, but we don't have a problem with stepping in and applying our epistemological values to their beliefs in the past. We think that we're right now and they were wrong then, and perhaps someone will prove us wrong sometime in the future, but you know that we're fallible, of course. But that doesn't stop us in the epistemic case. So I suppose I would be more gung-ho about applying the present-day principles to things in the past. Aristotle believed that women were inferior and slavery was okay. I think he was wrong about that.
I wonder whether we can make a difference between applying the kind of epistemic instruments, epistemic tools that we have today, looking at the past, might be problematic if what we are trying to do is establishing shame or pride. I think that might be problematic. It requires a sort of identification of the past that we might not be willing to have, and it raises problems, right? Who are we to judge? For some people, at least, who are we to judge?
But I have no problem with judging Aristotle.
I think that from a philosophical point of view is less problematic in a sense, because philosophers are interested in principles, and they look, when a principle is wrong, it's just wrong, no matter when it was put forward, right? But those kinds of consideration, I think, shouldn't be a problem if what we're trying to do is to establish responsibility for that past. So you can still recognise that something was wrong and that, you know, it needs to be repaired or it needs to be redressed. And that doesn't need the sort of judgments.
So there is this useful category of an excuse. So someone could do something that's wrong but not be responsible for it because they've got some sort of... There's a cluster of hands. Perhaps we could take two questions before moving on. Yes, in the second row. You.
Thank you very much for a very interesting discussion. So I think if we change the question slightly to say, can an individual be proud of her country's past? This is a question that some philosophers have tried to answer. And I'm just wondering then about sorry, Mihaly Mihai's response about shame, because it would seem to be a corollary that if an individual does feel proud of her country's past, that she also then is capable of feeling shame. I think this is something that Farid Abdelnour argued in one of his articles, in which he says, well, if you are going to be the kind of person who gets a sense of vicarious glory from your nation's past achievements, you can't pick and choose what your nation's achievements are. So you, to the extent that you feel pride of its achievements that are positive, you should also feel shame. And shame then can be a motivating force for you to correct problems that your nation faces, to the extent that you feel the sense of attachment to it. The other question I have is about responsibility then, which there's a bit of a tension between saying we want to acknowledge countervailing and counter memories, because it seems to me that a lot of your narrative about responsibility relies on the idea of benefiting from past injustice. And even on a case like the recruitment of Korean women into the Japanese military comfort system, sociologists show that, in fact, different women did have different experiences in different phases of the system, and some of them actually did see it as a benefit compared to their previous life before, or at least certainly not so much worse than the patriarchal society they confronted in Korea. So I guess one problem of admitting countervailing and counter-memories is that it might destroy the argument about benefiting from injustice, or at least that one must say that there might need to be some acknowledgement of past wrongs, whether or not contemporaries benefited. After all, benefit is not the only standard by which one can have responsibility.
I'll let you answer that, and then there's a question at the front, and then we're going to move on to another topic. Sid, would you like to answer this question?
Yeah, so with respect to, I completely agree with you, Catherine. I mean, it is, I think that when we consider questions about historical justice or injustice, and in particular issues of redress, in some cases, the fact that there were groups that benefited from their past matters more than in others. But even when it matters, it brings these other sets of questions about the complicity to some extent, or the choices, the benefits of the victims themselves. So I guess I wonder whether that could be addressed from by recognising that even that kind of involvement used categories that were somehow imposed as a matter of structures going on at the time. And so the fact that these women recognised or judged their position as improving with compared to what it would have been might just be a case of adaptive preferences at that time, or, you know, or just rational behaviour. So it's in what we need to look at is the fact that their options at that time were constrained by this more structural imposition or inequality. But I agree. I mean, benefit, it's one of the categories that we can use to acknowledge the fact that some of our past is in fact a history of injustice. Another category would be the persistence of that injustice in today's institutions, in today's society. That I think it's a slightly different way of looking at things. So it's not just the fact that we benefit, but that those injustices that started in the past are still with us today. And what we need to do to address them is to recognise that they're still here, even though they started a long time ago. And even though along the way we made some progress, but that's not enough. And in order to recognise that, I think you need to acknowledge counter-histories. So that might be a way. It depends on the perspective. Benefit doesn't exhaust the way in which we can think about past injustice, I think.
Yeah, I think that Sarah already very nicely explained how benefiting cannot be the only consideration. And I kept referring to identity, and what I was trying to do there maybe unclearly was to talk about normative consistency. If we are committed to standards of equal respect and concern, and if we have a certain understanding of ourselves, of a society, then we should make sure that we treat all members of our society with the same kind of equal respect and concern. About the shame, I agree with you, but I worry about the political use of shame, because the political use of shame tends to backlash. And you see, people always think that we're talking too much about the negatives and we're not talking sufficiently about the positive. And it's because shaming is uncomfortable and it's problematic and it's difficult and it's painful. So I worry about the political use of shaming. Of course, individuals will probably experience these things subjectively in very different ways. But yeah, that's my reservation about shame. About the Korean comfort women, I don't think there's a universal victim, and I don't think we should expect everybody to experience the exclusion or the suffering, the violence in the same way. Of course, there's going to be a variety of stories that come out of that community. But does that in any way excuse the fact that these women were transformed into objects and that were, you know, denied any form of agency? I don't know.
May I just jump in about the shame?
Yes.
I'm a bit ambivalent about this, and it's, there's a friend of mine. He's much more patriotic than I am, and we found an agreement that in the sense that even for him, that it's someone that takes pride in his country and in the history of his country. It's almost impossible to detach this feeling of pride from a feeling of shame. But I also see Mihaela's worries there, and it's easy if we think probably about Germany, where, again, was mentioned earlier. Germany has, because of what happened during the Second World War, a strong sense of shame as a nation or as a nation state with respect to that particular history, to the point that politics of shame to some extent makes them uncritic of what present conditions are and what the situation in Israel is today. So this I know is a very political sensitive topic, and generally we don't talk about this in academic circles, but that's precisely what I think you're hitting at when you talk about the excessive use of the politics of shame, that can make us uncritical to some extent to what's going on today, precisely because maybe we're looking a bit unreflectively, and we just that kind of shame blocks us. It's as if because of our history we can't judge anymore, and I think that's also a problem. So I'm not sure what to think. Mm. Probably, you know, there's a third way.
Maybe there's a gentleman at the front who's been meaning to get in.
Very, very interesting. One of the things that strikes me in all this is history teaches us that what we consider right and what we consider wrong, what we should believe, changes over time. So my guess would be that there's something all three of you are doing every single day that 150 years from now will be considered as appalling as we consider slavery now. So are you ashamed of it, even though you don't know what it is yet? Do you take ownership for that now? Surely it must be true. There will be something awful that we're all doing, that we're all believing. So how proud are we of what we're doing today, even though we don't know what we shouldn't be proud of?
It's a very good question.
I mean, yeah, I'm absolutely sure there are. I think probably what saves us is that, you know, we are not moral saints. So, you know, for sure in our... Probably the fact that I'm a meat eater in 150 years is going to look like, you know, a terrible injustice. I know that probably my meat eating is just a question of laziness and of moral failure of some kind. But I think what it's important is that, you know, with respect to the past, it's interesting. So looking at the past allows us to see that there is an intergenerational. We're just in transition, so to speak. And so what we do in our daily lives matters for the next generation. And I think, you know, with caution, being cautious of this might help us to recognise and the kind of duties that we have, and without the idea that because of that we're going to be more saints.
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. My answer would be, yes, I do take responsibility for whatever it is that it may be, but I don't feel shame for it, or not yet, because that would have to come with the belief that it was wrong. And so far, I haven't been convinced of it. If I had the belief, then I would feel ashamed of it.
Yeah.
So if I could sort of live to see the day, then I would certainly rue the day that I put ate that steak or whatever else it may be, but I don't have the belief yet. So I'm psychologically incapable of feeling shame, but open to the possibility that I might be doing something shameful.
Actually, I think that your question presupposes that at the time of the Atlantic slave trade, everybody believed it was a good thing, right? Well, it wasn't. And there were a lot of debates and there were a lot of arguments, and many people saw it as fundamentally wrong. I mean, if you look at the writings of the pioneers of abolitionism, and if you look at the writings of the Jesuits, and if you look at the writings of those who went to Catholicize Latin America, there are writings that prove that there was big disagreement about how you can save the soul of what they then called, I don't know, something terrible, right? So I don't think that we can cling to this idea that that was something that, that there's this disconnect between eras and that it's difficult to know what will be right in the next era, right? You see what I mean? So I think that there was always disagreement about the rightness or the wrongness of the phenomenon we're thinking now, which gives me hope that it's not unfair and it's not an example of presentism to think that that was something wrong. So I'm not unfairly applying standards that were not at all present in the public discussion at the time to a reality that's very different to the reality we live today. I don't know if that answers, but that's, yeah.
He's shaking his head, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on. So the second question that we plan to discuss, we've already really touched on, which is, given that we can feel some normative attitudes like pride and shame towards our past and our country's past, which attitudes are appropriate for people to have? Are there some attitudes that are just kind of off limits? So indifference, is that okay? If I just kind of always feel indifference, or some attitudes like feeling triumphant, are they kind of attitudes that it's never okay for a country to have towards its past? Would you add a little bit more on that, or do you feel we said enough about that?
Well, you know, I would raise indifference as soon as we, you know, learn of our past. There's bound to be some sort of reaction. That is, if you're someone that, you know, doesn't get ideas and subscribes to them without thinking. So I believe that there's always going to be a reaction. Whether that's pride, shame, or guilt, I mean, I think it should be a mixture.
Guilt might sometimes be appropriate for you.
In some cases. You know, sometimes it might become excessive to the point that we stop thinking or we stop acting. That shouldn't be. I think if guilty is appropriate when, as Mihailo was mentioning before, it can motivate us to act for the better, where the better is, you know, to recognise that there was something wrong going on and that we might have a responsibility to redress it, and to avoid that it's being reproduced today through our actions and through what we do today. So I guess, yeah, that's, I mean, it's, as you said, it's we touched on it before earlier, but
Would you agree with that, Mihaela, that there can be a range of emotions that are appropriate? Are any off limits?
It's very difficult to talk about emotion in these very regimental terms, right? It's very difficult to regiment public emotions and to say everybody should be like this or everybody should be like that, everybody should be not indifferent, everybody should be non-triumphalist, non-jingoistic, non-whatever. I think that we want to stimulate the development of citizens who are knowledgeable, who are aware, and who can make their own mind about the proper relationship to its past. And that presupposes a variety of stories about that past, right? So I cannot not go back again to the point about the various sources of narratives about the past. And of course, the state will be the main source, but then universities, you know, public intellectuals, artists, hopefully we'll have a plurivocal public sphere where sufficient alternative stories are produced so that citizens can start to think on their own reflectively about what the proper attitude should be. I'm a little bit of, skeptical about the regimentation of a certain type of emotion as the one appropriate emotion about history. I just hope there is a plurality and a healthy plurality of attitudes and emotions and
Well, let's move us on in this case, because our next question really falls out of this. If there are certain attitudes like pride and shame, all of these sorts of attitudes or emotions, they can make certain actions appropriate, I take it. If you feel guilt for something, and you're right to feel guilt for it, then it might be appropriate to make reparations. Or if you feel proud of something, then it might be appropriate for you to behave in different ways. So in what cases, if ever, is it ever appropriate for countries and peoples to make reparations for past wrongs? And can they be called upon by other people, perhaps the victims of those wrongs, to at least issue apologies or perhaps even financial compensation? Is that ever okay?
I definitely think it's okay. Before I go into the discussion of reparations, I think there's an idea that the harm can be monetarized, and that's a fundamentally wrong idea. Reparations can never compensate and can never capture the complexity of the harm that has been inflicted on a population, if we think about the enslavement of populations, or if we think about sexual enslavement and so on and so forth. So the financial component of redress, I think it's the only way of actually giving substance to other symbolic practices such as the apology. So an apology has a very important symbolic function because it acknowledges the harm, it acknowledges the existence of the victims, it acknowledges the continuation of the harm, it acknowledges all sorts of things that had been swept under the proverbial historical carpet. But on its own, it's not sufficient to count as meaningful unless it is coupled with some other more substantive, be it financial reparation or program of investment or of development or restructuring of the entire political system. So I really want to emphasize that reparations can never constitute a closure and an elimination of a debt, because the financialization, the monetarization of the harm leaves a lot of residue. The harm is too complex to be paid for. And the fact that it's been paid for, the fact that it's been apologized for, should not mark a moment of closure, but only the beginning of a more thorough and more critical reflection about who we are and who we are as the result of who we have been.
Sarah?
I sympathize to some extent with what Mihaela says, but I'm going to try something a bit more radical. Even.
Please do.
Excellent.
So, in one of the papers that I've written with Alasia, we precisely address the issue of how do we decide, you know, to redress, you know, what's appropriate redress for past injustices, especially when there is a very complex history, such as in the case of slavery and colonialism. So Catherine was right. What makes this history complex is precisely sometimes the involvement of the victims with, you know, the perpetrators of the injustice or of the wrongdoing. And just looking at episodes of past injustices makes the establishing what the appropriate redress for those injustices even more complicated, let alone establishing a number, a monetary amount as a reparation for these injustices. And so what we're thinking about this, we had two strong intuitions. One is that reparations should be a sort of bottom-up project. So we are also we discuss possibilities such as an international court for reparations in the paper, and we think that there is something troubling about this. So because it doesn't capture that the idea that victims of past wrongs have to play a part, a very important part in deciding how to redress and how to repair those wrongs. And so we come up with the idea of having a democratic principle to deal with this. So, and we also put forward a sort of institutional proposal. Instead of having an international court to deal with questions of reparations, what about having a democratic forum where former colonizers and former colonized can, discuss, and to some extent also, you know, get clear about what the wrong was about in the case of this complex past injustices, and then together decide what is an appropriate form of redress. And that might take the form of monetary compensation or the forms of apologies, but what is important is this idea of, you know, coming together in a way, recognizing that there was something wrong that happened, and that we acknowledging this fact is a collective enterprise that victims and past victims and past wrongdoers can do together, also in the hope of possibly stop reproducing or putting a stop to the very legacy of that past. So the idea of the democratic forum is also motivated by the fact that even if today we are unequal precisely because of that history, you know, a way to discuss these things together on an equal footing that constructs us as equals and gives us a fair say in matters of redress might overflow in the kind of standing or might transform our standing today.
That's really interesting. What sort of form would that discussion take? Presumably it wouldn't take the form of a negotiation.
No, exactly.
I take it that's not the case.
Yeah.
So
it's meant to be, we thought about structuring it in different sequence. So there is a first step, which is about, you know, establishing what is that the wrong was about. And obviously, because of our narratives and because of, you know, the selective application of pride in the way in which we understand our past history, there's going to be disagreement, even, you know, within former colonizers and not just among the colonized. So it is important to have this first exchange. And then once we are broadly in agreement about what is it that was wrong about it, then we can start discussing about the appropriate forum that redress should take. But it is important that kind of discussion is structured in a truly democratic way. So we refer, for example, to the use of facilitators and to the fact that, you know, to various procedural mechanisms through which we can minimize the risk of reproducing inequalities at that level. So we minimize the risk of, you know, those that are in a position of superior power, as if it might not be. You know, it's reasonable to expect. It's actually in the way of the discussion. I said it was radical. It's just, you know. But it's just to offer an alternative to courts and monetary reparations.
I think it's a wonderful idea, but I cannot possibly imagine the current Prime Minister of Britain and the current Prime Minister of Jamaica entering in this equal footing negotiation about...
That's the other thing. Mm. Not public officials. Mm. So we imagine this democratic forum where there are representatives of just citizens like us discussing, as we're doing today, about, you know, past injustice. Mm. So it actually, at some point in the paper, I think we mentioned that it wouldn't be appropriate for a public official to be the representative in this international forum.
You might think it's the sort of thing that could be done within the confines of an academic subject like history, but of course historians are very conscious to remove normative ideas from their findings, but maybe that would be an argument for a more normative sort of history that was able to describe the nature of a wrong rather than simply talking about causes and what happened.
Let's not be naive and think that historians or philosophers are not going to be partisan.
Well, I think at that point we better take some questions because our time is nearly over. Yes, in the middle in the black hoodie.
Thank you. It strikes me that a lot of the examples that have been used are from fairly recent history because perhaps they seem most pertinent and their effects are most obvious to us now. But in the previous discussion, I was wondering, if we can feel pride and shame, how far back is it appropriate to do that? Can I feel pride for my ancestors for creating stone tools, for example? And then to relate it to this question, why could Eastern Europeans not seek reparations for Genghis Khan or something of that, you know, similarly historical nature.
Right. Can we take one or two in a row? There's a gentleman at the front in green.
Yeah, so I wonder whether it's a very important thing about the question, the psychology of people, right? Because actually, I think the whole idea of being proud of a country is actually something that people are told to be and that responds to some kind of basic psychological needs, you could say, like to belong to a group and to associate something positive with the group, and that the whole discussion about whether this is justified or not, or whether people should rather feel guilty or a country should apologize or things, there is a different issue here, which is not whether this is justified or not, but this is rather whether it would be good and healthy for people to actually feel some kind of pride, particularly in Germany. Now, people often say it's not very healthy for us that we feel so much shame about our past, regardless of whether this is perhaps be justified. Let's be more proud because we are more healthy if we are more proud. And if you don't agree with this, then how to counter people who go to, let's say, 12 to 20 years old people, even many of older people, and tell them, you know, people tell you all the time you should feel shame, you should feel guilt, you should feel you should apologize, but instead, rather we tell you, well, there are some great things in our country, and you should be proud, and this is our group, and that's very attractive. So how to counter that?
Is there another question? Lady in the front here.
Yeah, I'd also like to make a more pragmatic point, and that is whether we like it or not, we are held responsible by people in other countries for the things that the politicians in our country did or in our name. I mean, I was one of the many people that marched against the war in Iraq at the beginning, the war in Iraq went ahead. I've never agreed with it. I think it's appalling. We're reaping the consequences now. But people in other countries think, you did the war in Iraq. You know, that's just from a... that. If I say I'm from the UK, then it's, oh, yeah, you guys, you were in Iraq, and you destroyed Iraq. So I think that's just a pragmatic point. But the curious example of the comfort women from Korea exploited by the Japanese army, I think the it was made so much worse by the decades of long denial that it happened in the, at all. So never mind pride and shame, acknowledging the fact that things happen. And I think your idea of a way of interchange and accord is such a interesting one, because just the acknowledging of something that happened for victims is so useful, because as a victim you no longer feel like trash. You know, you feel acknowledged, and that is one of the most important beginnings for a restoring of someone's humanity, self-worth, etc., etc. Yes, I found the example of the comfort women somewhat strange, I must say.
Okay, we should just about have time to pick up on some of those points. So just to recap, there's a question about how long ago. Is too long ago. There's a question about whether pride might sometimes be useful, even though shame might be appropriate. So this is a question that I was thinking about during the course of the discussion. Some of the arguments that you've been giving for feeling pride or for feeling shame have been that shame is good, it's useful, but maybe it may not be appropriate. So are we to decide to feel these attitudes on the basis of how useful it will be in the future, or on the basis of how appropriate it is to the thing done? And then just finally, there's a question about pragmatics. So in fact, we are held responsible. So take your pick.
I'll go through very fast through all three of them, because I found them all fascinating. I think you're absolutely right. It's a matter of salience. And when I talked about the reproduction of injustices into the present, of past injustices into the present, that's where the salience lies. So Denmark apologized to Ireland for what the Vikings did. Yeah, that was ridiculed and laughed at, and probably for very good reason. But we can't, you know, say the same thing or laugh in the same way about Jamaica's claim for reparation today, right? So it's about the continuation, and I think now we have to go back to Catherine and admit that the benefits and the continuation of the problem will bear some of the, you know, heaviest argumentative weight in what we're trying to say here. Regarding pride and shame, it's not a zero-sum game. What are you proud of as a German? Of the German team winning the World Cup? Or you're proud of the great engineering that's been going on? You know, if I were to follow a stereotype, you're not going to be proud about Pegida, are you? You see what I mean? So it's of course it's a psychological human need. Of course people need to belong to and form loyalty to something. It's the something that the problem lies with. What are you proud of? And that's where things can be very nicely parsed out. And yes, of course, I mean, people are accused for supporting, for voting and paying taxes to a government that goes on and starts wars in their name, and that's a fundamental claim that's being raised again and again. You can respond by saying, yes, I have done my citizen duty, I have protested, I've done everything in my power to oppose this measure, but given that our democracy is not as functional as we would like to, the claims didn't make it into the higher echelons of power, and there was a big disconnect between the decision-making at the higher level and the democratic will formation. But yeah, absolutely, that's what happens, and if democracy had worked, you know, perfectly well, then that argument would have been even stronger, yeah.
Or perhaps, you know, we could just accept that sometimes we can be complicit in injustices, even especially because of our democratic systems. Sometimes we win and sometimes our party loses, and we just accept that with the belief that the system, a system like a democratic one that allows to express our contestations and to express our disagreement, is still the best system that we can have. And I guess, don't stop. So, your contestation at the time of the war, wasn't heard enough. Maybe now there is a greater sensitivity to the fact that the mistakes were made. And it's important that the people who contested it originally, disagreed with it originally, continue to remind us that that was in fact a mistake, without necessarily abandoning the idea that living in a democratic system is probably the best thing that we can have, in spite of all its problems, and the fact that we can be complicit of this injustice is one of them, but it's not insolvable, I think. How far back we should go? It's an interesting question. I think a question that people working in historical justice get asked a lot, and I probably think that we need some sort of way to orient and to guide our energies and so. The pressing importance that those injustices have today in the forms of legacies or in the form of still being here with us, I think it might work as a way to guide our efforts and our energies today. Pride and shame. Again, I think, these are political emotions. And this is important, both the fact that they're political and the fact that they are emotions. So the fact that they are emotions tells us that, there can only be so much that you can do to control or influence.
People try to control them all the time.
Sure.
And very successfully.
Sure. So, and that is the political part. So I think that we should, recognise that the fact that to some extent that there's always going to be inevitable reactions to what's happening around us or to what happened in the past. And so, as Mihaela, again, who are in agreement, was saying, it's a matter of deciding what is it that deserves our shame and what is it that deserves our past. And then, in some cases it might be appropriate to take, rightful pride in the things that we should take pride in, but needs this reflection. It can't just, be something that we don't decide together, or we just let the politicians decide for us. I think that probably the best way is to present, and even in civic education, for example, to present things, to say objectively, it's almost a paradox here, but to expose facts of history and facts of today's policies, politics, to in a way that is, as plural as possible, and then the kinds of attitude that somehow allows us to break the control on the emotion and the knowledge of those events and let the individuals choose. Or let individual experience the kinds of reactions, emotional reactions that they want to have with respect to those events.
Well, I think we'd better stop there. Thank you so much for a really great discussion.
Thank you.
And thank you for our two panelists.